You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā, te rā tekau mawha o pautu te rangi. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 14th of March. My name is Lillian Hanley. Coming up on the show today, on Dear Science with AUT's Alan Blackman, we talk about poisons, measles and cervical cancer. Still no Tracy Martin. I'm kind of getting frustrated about this. I presume she'll be busy dealing with the education reforms being announced today and the reports regarding a 15-year-old that was kept in police cells for almost a week after Oranga Tamariki facilities didn't have a bed, or the fact that the CPTPPA was signed by the current government and New Zealand First was originally against it. But we will hopefully talk to her about that next week. We talked to Nikki Hago about the new developments regarding the New Zealand SAS being involved in a raid in Afghanistan. I speak with Grandmothers Against Removal on why it's not okay to remove Aboriginal children from their family. And Lisa Bode talks to William Harris from Otago about what's going on in Eastern Gouda. If you want to get in touch, tuku pātui mai wai mai rāne, text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. But now it's time for...
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, you can fuck off! How are we, Alan?
We're even better now, yes.
I just love the intro. Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about the chemical agent in the poisoning of the
Sergei
Russian ex-spy. Now, I want to know, Are you saying that Russia did it?
Oh, no, that would be far too much for me to say. But anyway, let's sort of get into the nitty-gritty of this. So Sergei Skripal was a double agent working for both the KGB and MI6, I think it was. He then sort of got caught out, as double agents tend to do. He got sentenced to 13 years jail in Russia in around about 2006. And then, again, as often happens in the movies, he got swapped in a spy swap for a whole bunch of other side spies, and went to live in England. And as everybody knows, it's been all over the news and everything, so he and his daughter still fighting for their lives, unfortunately, following a poisoning in Salisbury. And
so they're still in hospital?
They are, yes. And so as also a policeman, the first guy that was on the scene, I think he's still in hospital as well.
He was affected as well?
Yeah, I think there were about 21 people affected. So
wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is thoroughly...
strong poison.
Indiscriminate. You know, it's just awful, really. And... So it has been confirmed that they were poisoned using a nerve agent. And the nerve agent that they have identified looks very, very much like it was one of a bunch of nerve agents that were made in Russia from the 70s to the 90s. And so, you know, it's anybody's guess as to who is possibly responsible for this. But, you know, you'd have to say that all fingers are pointing towards sort of the high-ups in Russia. What is a nerve agent, I guess, is sort of, you know...
That's what I was wondering.
That's the science part of it.
How does it work? Okay, so you've got this molecule in your body called acetylcholine. And every time a nerve fires, it sort of releases this molecule of acetylcholine. And that's the chemical that basically tells your muscles to contract.
Okay.
And so you fire off a nerve impulse, you get acetylcholine, your muscles contract, and then we've got this thing called acetylcholinesterase, which is a mouthful in itself, and that's an enzyme, and what that does is then it destroys the molecule of acetylcholine after it's done its job.
So that you're not contracting the time.
There you go, exactly right. So you've got your nerve impulse, acetylcholine, muscle contract, acetylcholinesterase destroys the acetylcholine, and then it waits for the next nerve impulse. Now, as you exactly said, if you can somehow stop this acetylcholinesterase enzyme doing its job, then the acetylcholine is just going to build up and build up and build up, and your muscles are just going to contract and contract and contract, and you'll just go into spasm.
Holy shit.
So all your breathing and everything, you know, you're gone. And so that's the way that nerve agents work. And nerve agents were first developed in Nazi Germany pre-World War II. So there were two famous ones called Tavin and Sarin. And thankfully, they haven't been, or they weren't used by the Germans, but they were, however, used back in the mid-90s, 1995. There was a attack on the Tokyo subway. I don't know if you remember that. The Om Shinrikyo sect. Shinrikyo. You know, you haven't heard of that?
Nope. Yeah.
So, yeah, they released all this stuff in the Tokyo subway, and about 12 people died, and this was a nerve agent. This was sarin that they used, so this was the original German stuff that they'd used. And obviously, you know, once one side had this nerve gas and the other side had to get their hands on it, so the British started developing nerve agents after World War II, et cetera, et cetera. And there were sort of two generations, I guess, of these things, and then the Russians came in with this third generation of nerve gases, which were, you know, obviously made by them. And these are the ones, or one of these anyway, that is thought to have been used in the poisoning of these unfortunate folk. So, again, it's not an absolute certainty because, unfortunately, if you want to go out and make a nerve agent and you're a halfway decent chemist, then you can do it. It's not too difficult. Okay, so it's not like polonium. Now, remember Litvinenko, the guy that got poisoned with polonium about 10, 12 years ago? So he got poisoned with polonium, and polonium can only come from a nuclear reactor, and, you know, there's only so many places that can come from. So that obviously came from Russia, you know. That's
easily traceable.
That was easily traceable. This is a little bit more difficult.
You're saying because a lot of people would be able to do it?
Yeah, basically. You know, the recipes are out there if you know where to look. And certainly if you're a trained chemist, then, you know, you can do that. And about sort of 15, 20 years ago, a chemist in the States sort of did this just to show that how easily it could be done. And he was testifying before Congress or something like that, and he just decided to try and buy all the precursors to make a nerve agent. And he did it very, very easily, just sent off to the chemical companies, and it all came, and it cost him $130, and he could have made a couple of kilos of nerve agent, which could have wiped out about 10,000 people. So,
holy shit.
So sadly, if you know what you're doing, these things aren't too difficult to make. The big trick is in not killing yourself while you're actually making them, but, you know, you've just got to take sensible precautions and everything. So
you were saying we're not entirely sure if this particular nerve agent was used, or we're fairly sure?
Given that I probably want to travel to Russia one day, you know.
Well, we can leave it there.
And this will be on the internet, you know, forever. Then
we can leave it there then. Thank you, though. That was fairly visual, actually.
It's really nasty. I mean, what horrible bloody people would do this, knowing that bystanders are going to be affected and everything. Same with the polonium as well. It was a miracle that somebody else didn't die in that.
Can you explain that, though, in terms of how it does affect, like, is this what form did they release it in?
This vapor was
how does it
so hang on the nerve gas or the polonium
The nerve,
oh, the
gas.
Nerve gas.
Well, it's not a gas, actually. It's most of these things are liquids.
So how does it affect the other people around?
Well, I think the policeman was doing mouth to mouth, I believe.
Okay.
And I think anybody who just actually comes in contact, I think that's, you know, okay, it goes through the skin and stuff. So,
but if it's liquid, it could have been like through food or
that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay. All sorts of ways. So I think there's a lot that we're not being told about this, and that'll come out in the fullness of time. So,
okay.
But it's horrible.
We'll come back to it.
Yeah.
Measles. There's been an outbreak at AUT. Can I just ask, are you infectious?
Well, let's say that one is hardly an outbreak, Lillian. Let's not get sensationalist.
All right, sorry.
But no, it has been in the Herald and stuff. So, unfortunately, we had one student across the road who was confirmed case of measles, and so as a result of this, you know, there's been a lot going on in trying to identify people who haven't been vaccinated against measles and stuff, and then they're quarantined, they're not allowed to come to university, they've got to stay at home, etc., etc., and the district health board are running around doing blood tests and everything. So, you know, it's all being handled, etc., etc., and, you know, people are doing a really great job at this. Yes, I am immune because I had measles when I was a kid. So if you're born pre-1969, then apparently chances are you've either had it or you've sort of got some sort of natural immunity to it. So
Was it compulsory vaccination before that and then that stopped?
No, it wasn't.
You're just saying because you've had it.
I had measles so when I was a kid. So that was just a rite of passage that you went through. Everyone got measles, mumps and bloody chicken pox, you know.
And the same process occurred? You just stayed home or...?
Yeah, I think so. I can sort of barely remember, but yeah, you just, you know, you went through it, you scratched like hell or whatever, I can't remember exactly, but so I'm okay, but sadly there are people who are not vaccinated, not immunised, and so therefore they are at risk. And as I say, people are busy trying to identify those folks as well at the moment. So
is it like chicken pox, where if you get it as an adult, it's harder on your body?
Indeed,
as well?
Yes, yeah, and then that gives you
You're asking us?
Yeah, I know. I know. Okay. That really nasty thing, not scabies. No, I'll think of it anyway. Okay. It's gone. But what I wanted to talk about was sort of the history of vaccination. It just sort of got me thinking, you know, how did vaccination all start and everything? Mm. And, it's a really cool story. I mean, hopefully...
Cool?
Well,
is that?
Well, that's probably not the word. Not for the people involved necessarily, but so hopefully most of the listeners have heard of Edward Jenner, who was the first guy to supposedly... introduced vaccination. So he was born in 1749 and he became a doctor and blah, blah, blah. He also had interests in natural studies, I guess, sort of biology and things like that. And he was the first person to observe that, you know, how cuckoos go around laying their eggs in other birds' nests.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so when the cuckoo hatches, when the baby cuckoo hatches, it then kicks all the other eggs out of the nest. Or all the little hatchlings and everything like that. They're nasty bastards, cuckoos. They really are.
Just because they want the nest to themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so then the parents have only got this one to look after, and then it gets, you know, that's the way they do it. No brothers or sisters. It's mean.
Yeah.
But anyway,
where are we going with
well,
this?
Well, he was the first person to show that, actually. He was the first person to observe that, and he published it and everything. But in 1796, so...
people were texting in saying shingles.
Shingles, that's it. Okay. Thank you. Shingles.
All right,
shingles.
Sorry to derail that.
Right, thank you, Texas.
Thank you, Texas. Three people.
Somebody's listening. Three people are listening. That's great.
Okay.
So Jenner. So, in 1796, so he had heard a lot about the fact that... dairy maids, as they call them in those days, so basically the women who milk the cows, they never got smallpox, but they got this thing called cowpox. And cowpox was sort of a mild form of smallpox. And so Jenner was sort of interested in this, and he sort of drew the conclusion that, oh, there must be something here. So obviously if you've had cowpox, then you don't get smallpox and your face doesn't get all pockmarked and you don't look like, you know, because that's what smallpox did. And so what he then did was he came across a dairy maid by the name of Sarah Nelms. And that's brilliant that her name is known to history. I think that's fantastic. She's not anonymous. And what she had was some fresh cowpox lesions on her arm and her hand. And so what he did, he took some matter, as they say, out of these lesions. And then he injected that matter into an 8-year-old boy by the name of James Phipps. Yeah, indeed.
Lisa, you're laughing.
I just don't think it would be possible to do it now.
You couldn't do that
back
now.
In the day.
You would not get ethics approval to do this experiment now. You just wouldn't.
That's how now we have vaccinations. So.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
well,
this entirely unethical experiment led to vaccinations. So this poor little 8-year-old kid, I mean, and again, it's wonderful that his name is known to history as well. And I think he needs a bloody statue or something somewhere because... You know, as a result of him, you know, millions of lives have been saved and smallpox has been eradicated. It's gone, you know, as a result of vaccination. So these two people, Sarah Nelms and James Phipps, they are heroes of science, absolute heroes. As I say, it is really, really good that we know their names.
Was James okay?
Well, As it's said, he developed a mild fever after having... Oh, yeah, oh, no. We haven't even got to the worst bit.
No,
we haven't
okay.
even got to the worst bit. So after a few days, he said he felt cold and he lost his appetite and everything. And then 10 days afterwards, he felt okay. So then, 2 months later, Jenner took some fresh smallpox matter from a fresh smallpox lesion and then...
Again.
No, this was smallpox. This wasn't cowpox. This was smallpox.
But again into James?
And again into James to see if he was immune. And he was.
Whoa.
That was a bit of a gamble.
So he was potentially giving this kid a life-threatening disease. And it worked. So, you know, utterly extraordinary.
So then they continued more studies?
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, he was sort of running around looking for volunteers for about 3 months around London and couldn't find any.
Funny. Can't imagine why.
But in the days before that, they used to actually do a similar sort of thing, but they'd find people who had a mild case of smallpox, and they'd do a similar sort of thing. They'd stuff it up their nose or something like that, and you know, if you were lucky, you got a mild case of it, and then you were immune after that, because that's the thing. Once you get smallpox, then you're immune to it after that. So, so you know.
History of vaccinations.
Dear. Quite remarkable. So there we go.
Wow. Final topic. I think we'll just have to rush through this
we
one,
will.
But this is great news.
Oh, it is. This is all about vaccinations as well. So HPV, so the human papilloma virus, and so we now vaccinate against this because this can cause cervical cancer. And apparently, I was reading one woman dies of cervical cancer every couple of minutes, I think, on planet Earth.
Really?
Wow. Which is just appalling. I think something like that anyway. And Australia are going to be the first country to probably eradicate this.
Now,
completely.
What does that mean? Have they vaccinated so that nobody will get it, therefore it cannot be passed on? Or?
Well, they've started vaccinating. That's the thing. So amongst 18 to 24-year-olds, so the prevalence of HPV has dropped from 22% to 1.5%
wow,
over the last 10
pretty
years.
Pretty massive.
Which is just extraordinary. And so this is a paper that's just been published in a Journal of Infectious Diseases. And they're saying that they're predicting that 30 or 40 years down the track that basically cervical cancer as generated by HPV will be gone.
So cervical cancer won't be gone itself.
Yeah, not
but,
that well,
but
you know, this yeah, as
HPV.
Yeah, but the HPV
virus that
yes,
that
yeah,
causes,
yeah,
causes
yeah,
it.
Yeah. So they're going to get rid of that, so
30
you know,
or 40 years.
Yeah.
That's
so
not far down the track.
It's not really, and surprisingly there's only about just over 50% of women in Australia are vaccinated at the moment. And so they've got this remarkable decline because obviously they're starting to vaccinate the young women, you
yeah.
know. So I think at age 12 or something like that, I think you get...
You can go for it.
I think it's something
it's
like
very
that.
Young.
Yeah,
mm.
yeah, yeah. But, you know... This,
do
this
we
is,
have numbers for, you know, what? How many women are vaccinated here?
No, I don't. I should have looked that up. But
that's right.
But Australia's sort of the world leaders in this one, but I think we're doing this now as well, and... I'm pretty sure, aren't we?
Yeah, we've definitely started pushing it in schools or high schools anyway.
Yeah, so it's not, you don't have to get it. So it's
wait, so
voluntary.
Is it compulsory in Australia?
Got a feeling it might be, but I'm not sure. Oh, jeez, I came on badly informed here, didn't I?
That's all right, Emma.
You're asking me all the hard questions.
That
today,
will
Megan.
Encourage people to go out and look this up, I hope.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, that's great news, so... Vaccination rocks. And happy Pi Day.
Pi Day?
It's Pi Day.
What kind of pie?
Oh, well, if you're
any
in America,
pie?
Then you know how you put the month before the day.
Yeah.
So it's 3/14.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which are the first three digits of pi, 3.14.
Oh, pi. Like,
so
yeah. Oh, I thought you were talking about food. Right, we are talking about science. Sorry.
Yeah, we're really not sciencey
it's
people.
It's Pi Day.
Here.
It is Pi Day. There we go.
Okay.
Yes.
Hey, that's cool.
Great. Just showcase our ignorance. If it wasn't clear before that.
All right. Thank you, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
Thanks.
See ya.
That was Dear Science. The Auckland Arts Festival brings you the Festival Playground at Silo Park, a resplendent new space for music, art, food and family fun. March 15th at Festival Playground, Aldous Harding and Perfume Genius, lush, electrifying and transcendent. Aldous Harding and Perfume Genius are artistic kindred spirits playing individually and together for one beautiful and poignant night. Auckland Arts Festival's Festival Playground, March 8th to the 25th. For information, go to aucklandfestival.co.nz.
Coming with high praise from star of Splash, Tom Hanks, Elin Jewell and her band are headed down under, bringing their sultry, surf noir and dynamic Americana with them. If you want to win yourself some tickets, then just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week.
Well, hang on, baby, till the day I die, it is true.
95BFM's Border Radio presents Elin Jewell, live at the Tuning Fork, Saturday, June 2nd, tickets from Ticketmaster.
I got a bit of a serve yesterday on the text messengers for being so politically biased and you know, going on about it all the time. But I mean, have you been alive for the last 9 years? Exactly.
The Wire.
The New Zealand Defence Force has admitted that they were in fact operating in the area in Afghanistan outlined by the book Hit and Run released last year. The book stated that 6 civilians, including a 3-year-old, were killed and 15 others were injured because of this operation. At the time of release, the Defence Force stated that they were not operating in that area at all. I spoke with Nikki Hager, co-author of Hit and Run, to find out more.
Nearly exactly a year ago, this is like in 2017, this book called Hit and Run came out, which was about New Zealand SAS being involved in a raid that went wrong in Afghanistan. They didn't mean to do it, where they thought they were shooting up insurgents, bad people who had been attacking the New Zealanders, what they actually did was shoot up a whole lot of children and their parents and families in a town where there weren't any insurgents. And rather than realizing they'd made a mistake and admitting it and, for example, going back and giving medical aid to the people who were there, they just kept the whole thing quiet, went away, shut it up, denied it when any rumors of it came out. And so for all the years since, like 7 years since, there's been a cover-up about it. And my co-author and I separately had met people who were inside the system who were unhappy about what had happened, who had been there, for example, who were unhappy about what had happened and wanted the story told so that these things couldn't be hidden and they were less likely to happen again. So it was a very important book. And then the most incredible thing happened when it came out. We thought that if we laid it out, we named each person, we said where they were lying on the ground, what their lives were like, all the build-up to the operation, all the step-by-step, like the whole story, chapter-by-chapter, we thought it would be impossible for the Defence Force not to say, okay, we don't agree with some details, but yes, there is something to look at here. In fact, they headed into, they basically continued the cover-up. They denied everything, and they came up with a trick, which is what's just been undone in the last 24 hours, which is they said, oh no, we weren't even there. This book is about a different operation from our one. We did have an operation on that night with the same name, but it was a completely different operation, so all this stuff about civilian casualties has nothing to do with us.
So, as you say, it's come undone in the past 24 hours, and it's actually the New Zealand Defence Force that have announced that the photos used in the books are in fact the same area that the NZSAS unit was in,
yes,
where those civilians died. What does this mean? Like, why have they come forward now?
So this wasn't a willing offer of information from the Defence Force. What happens is that me and other people from the media have spent the last year probing them with questions under the Official Information Act, and coming back and back and back with more questions, and then the Ombudsman got involved for months, the Ombudsman who reviews official information things. And finally the Ombudsman forced them to put some information out, some extra information out. For example, challenging them on what we'd been asking them, saying, you see these photographs in the book, there's a house there, this looks very like where you say you went. Are the photographs in the book of the same place where you did your raid? In other words, are the book and your statements talking about the same raid? And they finally admitted that. So their main diversion and denial at the time of the book got undone. But if anyone went to this information package, which is on the Defence Force website, they didn't let it out willingly. You'd have to read it really carefully and know the issues before you'd even know, and they'd back down. They didn't front up and say, okay, we admit, we made all these public statements, we ridiculed these journalists for getting their book wrong, and now we have to back down and say that we were actually, it was us who were wrong, and it is the same thing. That would be what you would expect of people, you know, senior officers with integrity, but actually they've just kind of buried it deep inside the information they've released, that yes, maybe our diversions and denials weren't correct.
What's the motivation for keeping it so under wraps? Not only the New Zealand Defence Force, but the fact that there hasn't really been, like, has the media jumped on this, or?
What the media, when the book came out, yeah, the media was very interested in it. And then, because I was on the spot, let me explain what it felt like. We had the first few days after the book came out where everyone was talking about it, with the picture of the little girl who died was in the papers everywhere, little Fatima. It was getting a lot of attention, and then the Chief of Defence Force, Tim Keating, held a press conference where he said he was going to rebut the book. And what he did was, he didn't say, this is what they say, but we can prove that these things they said aren't true. What he did was, he came up with that thing I described, which was, he said, oh, there's just been a terrible mistake here. It's not the same raid. We weren't there. It's all wrong. And so what happened was they were basically just trying to wriggle out of the whole thing.
On very minor details.
On the minor detail. But what happened was, the journalists poured out of the press conference with him, and had asked me to wait on the steps in front of Parliament to meet them when they came out. So this crowd of journalists there who confronted me with the news, Nikki, what's going on here? They say you've got the wrong raid. It's the wrong valley, wrong place, not the same thing, which was a kind of a heart-stopping experience. Had we got the whole book wrong? Were we completely wrong on the whole thing? And then it's gradually become completely clear that this was a tricky diversion by then, so that they wouldn't have to answer questions about having civilian casualties from their operation and then covering it up.
In terms of your journalistic skills, was that just you knowing that you were right? Or was it you wanting to push to prove that they were wrong?
We knew we were right, really. The good thing about the kind of work that I do is that I don't have to publish if I don't think I've got something right. And if it's not sure or it's only one source and haven't been able to corroborate that source, you don't have to put it out there. And so this was the result of a few years of careful interviews. And like my main source, I met like for long interviews more than 20 times, picking over the exact details and cross-referencing it with what John Stevenson's sources were saying, and gradually, you know, making sure that you're never 100% certain about every fact, but that all the main things and all the main allegations were right. Maybe we were wrong on a few little details because it was hidden, it was deep in the mountains and things, but basically we wouldn't have published if we weren't really sure. And so when they denied the whole thing, and then they took the same arguments to the government and said, you don't have to, this was the national government then, you don't have to have an inquiry because they've got the wrong place. Ho, 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 wrong place, nothing to look at here. Don't worry about this list of children who have been injured and killed and things, because there's nothing here at all, they've just got the wrong place. It was actually really important that we stuck up for our work and kept working on it so that they couldn't use such a crummy little trick to get out of it.
I might have this a bit confused, but how is that even an answer? Because there's still people that have died. You know, so what if it was a different operation?
Well spotted. It was a really weak argument, but they were saying, we weren't there, it was nothing to do with us. And I should explain something. We gave them the opportunity to do this, in part, because we made a small mistake in the book. The text of the book was all correct, but one of our maps had the location of the villages, which was in these trackless, I mean roadless, mapless mountains, slightly wrong. And so that gave them the excuse to say, oh no, they've just got completely the wrong operation. And it wasn't true. We'd made a tiny error on one illustration or two illustrations. But they used that, they exploited that as their vehicle for trying to deny the whole book. And that's the important thing. So the location of it shouldn't have been the main thing, and now that they've backed down on that, that's not the end of the story, because they still haven't admitted the rest of it, but at least it means we've pushed that diversion out of the middle of the road, and we can get on to the real things, which is they say that they were fighting insurgents and they only shot insurgents and that this insurgent was shot here and those weren't shot there and things, and we say, no, those were children and their parents. And now we have a real fight over the really substantial things that they're still denying and covering up.
So what does happen next?
You probably heard in the news that the government, the new government, the Labour New Zealand First Green government, has said that they are considering having an independent inquiry. Up till now, it's only been the Defence Force supposedly investigating itself and finding nothing wrong. What's hopefully going to be happening in the near future, maybe after Easter, they've talked about, there'll be an announcement of an independent inquiry, like a genuinely independent inquiry, hopefully, set up by the government to find out who's telling the truth about what happened there. And that's actually exactly what we asked for in the book. It's the perfect thing to have happening. And as long as they have strong terms of reference and a good person or people doing the review, I feel really confident that they're going to come out and find that everything we put in the book was correct. And the denials from defence are this kind of outrageous set of lies.
That is good. When we looked into it, obviously, when the book came out, the McLeod and Associates, the lawyers, were they representing the villagers?
Yes, that's right.
And they argued that an army inquiry wasn't good enough, right?
That's right. So luckily, other people have come into this. And so there's three Auckland lawyers, including McLeod and Associates, they are running a court. They've actually tracked down the villagers, like the people whose families were killed and injured and things, and they're representing them in New Zealand. So these supposedly non-existent victims, have actually got their families in regular communication with these lawyers, asking them to find out the truth about what was done to their loved ones. So there's people like me who are digging into the information, but there's actually these lawyers who are also pushing the government at the same time to have a proper inquiry and then to get to the truth.
On a final note, to me, right, the reason for the New Zealand Defence Force to kind of cover this up, apart from the obvious in terms of that it's completely messed up, but that generally we have this understanding that New Zealand's military, you know, presence overseas is a generally peacekeeping mission, right?
I think what we have is an impression which is created by the Defence Force, actually, that what we hear about what the Defence Force does, so I was actually running my eye for another reason down the list of Defence Force press releases in the last couple of days. So I was just doing it yesterday, in the last year, I was just doing this yesterday actually, I was looking at their press releases. And if you read their press releases, you would think that the Defence Force only spends its time in the South Pacific helping lost fishing boats and cyclones and stuff like that, whereas actually the main activities that they are doing in the world at the moment, like most of their deployments in the world at the moment, are different ones in the Middle East, which is a very long way from New Zealand and far away from how New Zealanders see their role in the world of what they would think their Defence Force was doing. So I think mostly we're misled by the military-public relations. But you are putting your finger on the really important point here, which is what the reason this inquiry is important is that most people didn't know and wouldn't have believed that our Defence Force was going off and doing what was essentially a revenge raid, was being so careless that they shot up a whole lot of innocent civilians, and then they would cover this up. And we need to be able to know about what our Defence Force does, not just what the PR department wants to tell us, but the real things that go on. Because first of all, that holds them accountable, and we can say when we don't like it, but also we can say that we don't want them to do that kind of thing. But if the whole thing stays secret, if the whole thing is just kind of blurred and PR and what we want to hear but not what we're hiding, what we don't want to hear, then the public don't get a say on whether they think they should be there at all.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Around 100 sick or injured civilians have been permitted to leave the eastern Ghouta region of Syria yesterday. These evacuees are the first people to leave the zone since the short-lived ceasefire led by Syria's ally Russia and decided last month. The ceasefire is one of many that have been agreed on since the beginning of the fight in this region in 2012. The 400,000 residents of the zone have been trapped in there for years, and the recent escalation of violence has meant severe shortage of food and medicine. I spoke with Otago University Professor William Harris and started by asking him to explain why this region is so instrumental in the wider conflict and how did the situation get this bad.
Eastern Ghouta is an area of the suburbs of Damascus, quite close to the centre, to the northeast, and it's been held by the rebels since 2012. It's been quite a significant area of land. And to some degree, they've had food supplies from that land itself, as well as stuff that's been smuggled in. So any siege has only been imperfect. And for the regime, this is the last remaining rebel stronghold on the edge of the capital itself. And to take it would give Bashar al-Assad considerable military relief in his centre of power, as well as obviously a prestige boost.
May 2017 was quite an important date. There was a ceasefire deal and it wasn't really respected, and also it coincides with the instauration of a de-escalation zone. So yeah. Maybe try to do a little catch up on what's been going on ever since.
We can start with 2016, because in 2016 there was a regime and Hezbollah offensive against the eastern Ghouta, and they managed to clip off a reasonable amount of its territory, and that was facilitated by an important factor, which is infighting between the rebel groups or among the rebel groups within that area. There's a large group by the name of Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, which has been backed by Saudi Arabia, and it competes both with a smallish group of al-Nusra jihadists and a and another rebel group called Falak al-Rahman, which was part of the old Free Syrian Army, and is less Islamist, I suppose you could say, than the others. And these especially Jaish al-Islam and Falak al-Rahman fought each other at the same time as the regime was doing this offensive. And that was very detrimental for that area and its long-term holding capacity. And then in 2017, as you say, May 2017, there was this arrangement patronized by Turkey, Russia and Iran that have been together in a rather difficult alignment since then. And they dreamed up these de-escalation zones in western Syria, by which there were ceasefires between the rebel groups and different areas and pockets on the one hand and the regime on the other hand. But of course that's collapsed in the Eastern Ghouta, because the regime has been determined and is backed by the Russians to clear that area away. And one wonders what sort of trade-offs have gone on here with regard to the rest of western Syria. Because of course Turkey has been very active in the north, and the Russians have stood back from that. And Turkey has said actually very little about what's been going on in the eastern Ghouta. So one wonders if there isn't some sort of trade-off by which the Turks buttress the area that they patronize in the far north at the expense of letting go of this area near Damascus.
And so what's going on at the moment? What's been going on in this area since 2018?
Well, if we're talking about the Eastern Ghouta, yes. Of course, there's been a major regime offensive backed by Russia since mid-February. And as you know, with about 1,200 civilians killed by quite heavy aerial and surface bombardment, and the ceasefire attempts, including a United Nations attempt, an actual resolution from the Security Council, have counted for nothing. The West has stood back from all this, despite its verbal engagement. In real terms, it stood back, and it's hard really to judge who is the more cynical in this, whether it's the Russians, who had no intention of honouring the ceasefire and dreamed up a humanitarian corridor which couldn't possibly work, and they knew it couldn't possibly work, whether it's them who are the most cynical, or the Western powers that quite plainly never intended to put any enforcement behind their participation in the Security Council resolution.
So it's all show and no action, really. It's just taking positions.
From the Western powers, absolutely. Mm. I mean, nothing. I mean, there has been some noise from the United States and France about use of chemical weaponry, meaning chlorine gas, by the regime side in this affair, which obviously has quite a long history. And there have been threats from the U.S. to strike if there's a continuation of use of chemicals by the regime. The regime simply, despite the fact the regime was hit last year, of course, for using sarin gas further north in western Syria, despite that, they don't really take the United States seriously and feel that they have cover from the Russians. And the Russians have also been making noises that they may react to any Western military intervention.
What is the humanitarian situation over there?
Oh, it's really hard to judge that from here, but as far as we can tell, it's absolutely awful. And those people obviously are short of food, and the 400,000 or so people within what's left of that enclave, which has now been split into three bits. And of course the military offensive goes on, and as medical facilities have been targeted through this, the capacity to look after wounded people is limited. So we do know all that, but beyond that, of course, we're not there, and it's hard to have a serious, detailed reading of the situation. But all we know is that it's really bad.
The conflict in Syria has been going on since 2011, and throughout these past 7 years, it has heavily complexified. What was a civilian uprising heavily repressed by the regime turned into a fight between national and international entities, with civilians trapped in the middle and often used as instruments of propaganda on either sides. Staying well informed on the matter has become increasingly difficult, as both the regime and the rebels use existing or new network to push their agenda forward. I asked Professor Harris how he keeps informed and how journalists can navigate the grey waters and portray the conflict in as much of a truthful light as possible.
I follow, obviously, internet sources that a lot of other people follow. There's a pretty good one that your listeners might be interested in, which is Syria Live Map. If you feed that into the internet, you get quite a reasonable running commentary, which seems not to be too oriented to this or that side, and reports what's happened to each of them against a map background. And that looks to be a fairly decent source. Also, I use the Arabic, the mainline Arabic press, a newspaper called Al Hayat, and another one called Sharq Al Awsat. Al Hayat is also, I think, a fairly reasonable source. It has Saudi backing, but it also wants to present itself as an international Arabic newspaper of record, so it feels it has a reputation to uphold. So it's not too bad as well.
I also wanted to talk maybe a little bit about the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and how I feel like it's still held as like the main source of information for a lot of Western media, and whether it really should be.
My feeling about that is that they're actually reasonably conservative in a lot of their numbers. Several years ago, the UN was giving estimates of casualties and that sort of thing. The UN High Commission, or the UN Commission for Human Rights, and other UN bodies. And the Syrian Observatory was giving figures that were lower for casualties at that stage, which is three or more years ago, than the UN. So I think it gives you a reasonable picture that they do. Those people who operate in Britain, and for a long time I think it's been to a large degree a one-man operation. They say that they match, that they try to get corroboration of casualties. They try to put forward numbers that represent casualties that they can actually document in one way or another. I mean, I think this is the case with virtually every conflict like this, that there's a difficulty in getting hold of well-developed numbers as to casualties and that sort of thing. I think the Syrian Observatory tries its really best to do a decent job, and as you know, it is used by a lot of Western sources. I think the general trend it gives, the general level of numbers it's giving, are probably reflective of reality.
Do you think that the media, well, at least the Western one, I guess, is kind of still stuck in a very Manichaean vision of the conflict, still kind of like good guys, bad guys, you know, the regime, bad guys, the rebels, good guys, and kind of like overlooking the complexity of the entire conflict?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of grey zones amongst the various parties, and you've got the jihadists, and you've got the foreign interventions of various descriptions. And everybody's been shelling and bombing, of course. And I don't think you can entirely remove a moral plane from this. And here I can only give my perspective. My perspective is that the regime is the origin of this mess. The way the regime behaved in the years before the breakdown, the way the regime behaved in the trend from a protest, from street protests and a street uprising towards full militarization. The regime has been the major engine of causing casualties and that sort of thing. And we have some really horrific stuff against this regime in terms of the prison systems it's been running, in terms of the thousands of people that have been killed in prisons, the use of poison gas, the bombing of civilian medical facilities, that sort of thing, the bombing of queues at bakeries some years ago. it just goes on and on. And there's no question that the major breaker of human rights, the major criminality, is from the regime. And I know that's obviously a solid view in the West. Not one with much effect on what goes on there, of course. In addition to that, we have the backers of the regime that have kept this show going. And here we're obviously talking about Iran and Russia.
Yeah.
And also, none of those parties for a long time had too much serious interest in the degradation of ISIS, which for them was quite convenient for a considerable period. Mm. Because ISIS operated more against rebels than against the regime.
Yeah.
And ISIS was a good excuse for bombing rebels in general when the Russian bombing campaign got going. So I think there's a pretty good argument that there is a side to this that is more responsible than other sides, and that's the regime side.
Yeah, that being said, obviously... Well, we also ought to report on there are civilian casualties with the rebels.
There's plenty of stuff that's caused by other people. Of course there is, and that's the case with all such conflicts.
Yeah,
it's multi-sided, it's multifaceted. But if you look at the whatever numbers come out, it's the regime responsibility that hits you as number one.
Hmm.
And then others come in as number two, three, four, and whatever. And, of course, there's been all sorts of absolutely atrocious stuff that's been done by others in this conflict. But I don't think that takes the regime off the hook.
Since February 2018, the various rebel groups in Eastern Ghouta have lost a lot of ground, and many localities have been taken back by the loyalist forces of the Syrian regime. As more and more areas fall back into the regime's hands, the idea of the government defeating rebel factions altogether is becoming more likely. What will become of Syria when it happens? Professor Harris holds a pretty strong view on what has to happen next.
We're going to have the Russians and the regime come to us down the track if, in military terms, they get what they want, in terms of the reconstruction of Syria. And there's a big question for the West here as to the... If we regard the regime as the primary source of this entire mess, how can we take part in any reconstruction of Syria when there is essentially an unchanged regime?
But that's been a question that the West has been dealing with for quite a while now, probably ever since 2013 or something like that. And there's
I mean, we're sold a line from the regime, Russian, Iranian side, that only the Syrian people have the right to determine what happens to Syria, etc., etc.
Mm.
I don't accept that. Because of the international repercussions of this conflict, the flow of refugees, the effect on all sorts of other people right across the planet, we all have a right to a say in what happens to Syria. They have a right to elect what they like and that sort of thing, but we have a right not to approve of that, and we certainly have a right not to have our taxpayers' dollars go into reconstructing an unreconstructed regime.
But how do we get to the point where when I say we, I guess the West, doesn't back up the regime and the reconstruction? Like, how do we get out of this conflict without keeping al-Assad in power, at least for a little bit? Because he's so strong at the moment, I don't see how that's going to happen.
Of course he's strong principally because of his backers, whom he plays between, and he's quite good at that. The Russians, I imagine, watch him very closely. I mean, our choice essentially is, yes, maybe he's going to stay there. He is a war criminal. There's absolutely no question about that.
Mm.
It is our right not to spend money on supporting a show in which he continues to be the main mover. I know that may be tough for the population. And here, I think there's a differentiation between humanitarian aid and actual reconstruction of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly have my own perspective is that we must not be involved in reconstructing something that's under an unreconstructed regime. that that's our absolute bottom line. And we tell the Russians and the Iranians that there will be nothing from us, and we will do our best to frustrate things that do not produce a decent regime in that country.
Because if we support the reconstruction, it would be like giving our support to the regime.
That's right. I mean, you can generate an argument that anybody who knowingly, with that unchanged regime in place, is pumping money into Syria. Part of that money, of course, given the mafia-style behavior of that regime, part of that money will end up in the Caribbean and other such places. You've got to accept that. Maybe 20 or 30% of it will be siphoned off. And we just can't deal with a show like that. And we've got to make it very plain, if necessary, through use of things like vetoes at the Security Council, that we don't approve of exercises that don't answer our concerns.
Yeah, pretty strong opinion on the matter.
So that was Professor Wilson. I think just listening to that, we should be wary that that is a strong advocate for intervention, which we've learned over history. Western intervention isn't always.
Yeah,
it's not a great move.
The best way to help the people.
Mm. Often, Western intervention is actually what causes the issue in the first place.
Yeah, which is kind of what happened in Syria in the first place. So probably not the best outcome possible.
Perhaps we could look more into other voices on that issue.
Yes.
The Wire.
BFM Breakfast Club is coming to the Golden Dawn this Friday, March 16th. Join Mikey and pals for banter, breakfast, prizes and live music. Victuals from Ripe Deli, Coffee Supreme and Almighty Juice. And in the flesh performances from Carnivorous Plant Society and Cool Tan, FKA Heavy.
I see you doing double takes, see you wanna taste double like chocolate cake.
The first and last Breakfast Club at the Golden Dawn.
R.I.P. Golden Dawn, R.I.P.
This Friday, March 16th, 7 till 10am, thanks to Burger Fuel and NZ On Air Music.
Gaze upon a truer truth. Watch as cruel Mistress Entropy wraps her greedy lips around all of being. In a cosmic moment, we too will be smothered in the maternal belly of a nothing. Listen, can you hear the song the stars sing? In elegy of their own light.
Oh no, I'm so into that. I think I played it earlier.
Oh. Good, good.
Stare eternity in the face. The Wednesday Water Forward Bridge. Only on 95BFM.
Good, good.
Trust BFM? Sure can.
We are running out of time for our final piece about the grandmothers against removal, so hopefully we'll get to play that tomorrow. But Polyfest is starting this week, and producer Leah Garcia-Pervis did a little piece on what Polyfest is all about, speaking with Sueli Lee Moe.
Polyfest is on this weekend in Manukau. Over 10,000 students from over 60 schools perform at the annual event.
Polyfest has been running for 43 years now, so it's the most largest Polyfest for Māori and Pacific secondary school students in Auckland, but it's attracted so much diversity and a lot of different groups from outside of Auckland that we've just grown from strength to strength.
That's Sueli Lee Moe. She's been part of Polyfest for 15 years but became festival director last year. I asked her about who and what's new for this year's festival.
We've got Waiheke College. They've come over to try and get back into the Māori division. We've got Mount Richmond Special School, who are our disabled children, you know. So we're celebrating all our diversity, not just the cultures, but also the makeup of our children. And then we've got some amazing things going on for our primary and intermediate children who are on site today for the Schools Day program.
Last year, the government gave the festival $200,000, which is set to grow its support and financial structures. This year's event was launched by Labour MP Carmel Cipollone, who is Associate Minister for Pacific People. The festival has also garnered financial support from the Ministry of Youth Development. I also asked Sueli if she had any picks for this year's festival.
Are you allowed to give me your pick of the bunch?
But everyone's a winner to me.
Yeah. Oh, cool, cool, cool.
Polyfest finishes on Saturday night at the Manukau Sports Bowl. Call Leah Garcia-Pervis. Aho.
That was The Wire.
That was Your Wire. Big thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Alan, of course, Nikki Hager, Professor Harris, and Sueli at the end there. We have, there was a fairly fast piece done towards the end of the day, so also with the Grandmothers Against Removal, look out for that tomorrow, hopefully, or Friday. All good, Lisa?
Yeah, just next time we talk about Sarah, maybe we'll challenge a bit more this very Western idea that we have to intervene.
It's a certain narrative, isn't it, that does,
the Middle East.
We talk about it, and we're so detached from it also in the sense that...
I mean, I understand that people are like, you know, oh, Bashar al-Assad is such a terrible leader that he has to be removed for the sake of his people, but maybe we also can decide that it's not up to us to have a say in this.
We can decide that we don't get to decide.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you to my producers, and thank you to all of you who have been listening in. Thanks for the texts. Cheers Peter sent a text in. For decades, there has been a permanent state of war somewhere in the world, and very rarely is peace achieved. This tells me that there are people in power above government level who have a vested interest in keeping us in conflict and in separation. Fucking well said, Peter. More freedom, less government, of course, as he signs off. That's all from us today. Bridge's up next with the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95 BFM.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.